Welcome to the Straight Talk Physio Podcast with your hosts, Dr. Andrew Junak and Dr. Craig Giambattista. On today's episode, we're going to talk about what is a meniscus tear. We're also going to go through some not so common facts about what we consider the most common knee diagnosis. We hear the word meniscus tear thrown around in the clinic all the time. Tons and tons of patients get this diagnosis. A lot of times imaging has been involved. The patient's usually seen a surgeon or they've done a Google search. So a lot of times patients will come up with this on their own as well. It almost seems as like the worst thing that could happen to your knee. Oh my goodness. Like I have a meniscal tear. What do I do next? Craig, what's been your experience with this? I know we see a little bit different patient populations right now. But I know definitely in mine, like the athletic folks, meniscus tears it's the big one.
Yeah, I would say we are going to share the similarity because I think this is something that patients on any part of the spectrum that have knee pain will at least know about this or hear about it kind of in some point. I think as our listeners kind of hear what we have to say today, I think like the meniscus is kind of like the low-hanging fruit. Like it's such a common thing to be injured. So it's easy to kind of point the finger at like some structure that is damaged in your knee. And I think it gets blamed for a lot of knee problems, sometimes for good reason, sometimes for, you know, not so good reason. But I would say that a good majority of the people that I see with knee pain as a patient that has absolutely no idea of, you know, knee anatomy or knee pathology, like someone will come in and say like, you know what, it sounds like I was told it was a meniscus injury. I got an MRI and it says my meniscus is torn, you know, something about the meniscus. People are at least familiar with the term. Does that kind of hold true in the, you know, the higher level population?
Yeah, I think just the word meniscus, it makes sense to people, you know, unlike other terms like patellofemoral pain, or the other thing is ACL, PCL, LCL, MCL, like those words usually mean something to people too. So people will catch on like, oh, I hope it's not my meniscus, or I hope it's not my ACL or my PCL. When they first have an injury. So I think it is just one of those words that, you know, it gets thrown around a lot. People are used to hearing it in all different sports. You hear about it in football, basketball, you hear about it in runners, hockey. I mean, the dreaded meniscus tear it's all over the place. So with that being said, let's get rolling here. So what is a meniscus, or what are the menisci? Menisci is the plural for it. Craig, why don't you tell us a little bit about like the anatomy and the physiology behind the meniscus?
Yeah, great question. So the meniscus, we have two in each knee, so four total. And if we kind of think of our femur sitting on our shin bone, it kind of makes up the knee. The knee kind of looks like a door hinge, so kind of like a hinge joint. Your tibia, your shin bone is relatively flat, and your femur, your thigh bone, it kind of comes down and it's a little bit rounded on the edge. It has these two condyles on them, we call it. So what the meniscus does, they're two little C-shaped, like tough and rubbery pieces of cartilage that kind of sit in between that joint. And what they do is act as like a shock absorber. And because the tibia, our shin bone, is pretty flat, they can almost create like a little depth to the socket of when the femur kind of sits on it. So its main job as you're weight bearing or turning or cutting or, you know, whatever you're doing, it helps absorb a little bit of the shock put on the knees. Anything else you typically tell patients, or, you know, if that's what you typically go with when people have these injuries, like, what do they say? Like, what do you hear when people have like meniscus injury?
So from a patient standpoint, usually patients report a whole host of different things. So usually the pain is in the front of the knee, and most of the time they'll pick a side. They'll say it's like either more towards the inside or a little bit more towards the outside, but the pain for a meniscus tear, like 99% of the time, is always in the front of the knee. You can get like tenderness in the divots next to the patellar tendon. So most people know where their patellar tendon is. It's that kind of ropey structure just below your kneecap. And if you have your knee bent, you can actually like strum your finger right over it. And where people experience pain and tenderness with a meniscus issue is usually in the divots right next door. So either on the inside or the outside. The inside of the knee is considered the medial part. The outside of the knee is considered the lateral part. Patients will also report clicking and popping in their knees. Usually that clicking and popping is new and it's painful. So sometimes clicking and popping can happen. That's called a cavitation. We cover this extensively in our different podcast episodes. So feel free to refer back to some of our early works, especially in the low back pain, some of those. because we do talk a lot about that. But clicking and a popping in your knee that is not painful is usually not of concern. But people with meniscus issues, they will get a painful click or a painful pop. They might experience some knee catching or locking. So as they go to bend their knee or straighten their knee, they might feel like it gets stuck or it won't completely bend all the way or straighten all the way. This is a pretty common issue that we see with people with really bad meniscus tears. The knee can buckle. So as they're walking, moving, going up and down steps, they might feel like that knee is going to give out underneath them, almost as if it can't support their own weight. It'll just kind of jump out at them, catch them off guard. And then, you know, usually they'll regain their balance, but knee buckling is another common one. And then lastly, some of the things that tend to aggravate these folks who have meniscal tears, they struggle with knee bending, knee straightening. They'll struggle with squatting, and especially deep squatting. A lot of times, if you're only squatting to like a quarter of the way, or maybe even just the parallel, you might not feel it as much. But if you go all the way down, especially for higher level athletes, you'll feel it more at the end of ranges. For people who maybe have a larger issue there, and it's a little bit more symptomatic, they'll feel it in different variations of that squat. Usually pivoting is painful. Running is usually a no-go because, again, when you mentioned earlier about the meniscus being a shock absorber, lots and lots of pounding can also increase the pain. Repetitive jumping and also stair climbing tend to aggravate these folks. But clinically, do you see anything other than this, Craig? Again, I know you work with a different population. I'm sure you see a little bit more irritable meniscus tears than I do. Can you discuss what that's kind of like treating?
So the main difference that I would say would be just painful weight bearing in general. So it could be as simple as just walking or getting up from a chair. And I'm talking taking a couple steps, you know, as far as like a high irritability level sort of thing. But I think you hit like the subjective, like what we hear from patients. I think you hit that nail right on the head. And I think the hard part is like if someone's listening to this, this sounds like a lot of other type of knee pain, right? Like pain in the front of the knee, pain with squatting, pain with pivoting, you know, like a lot of various knee conditions can kind of cause this sort of stuff. I would say like the clicking and the popping can be a little bit unique to it, but not necessarily. So I think that, you know, getting this stuff evaluated by a professional is super important. You know, I think this is where like the dangers of like using Google as your doctor comes in, because somebody with knee pain could listen to all these symptoms we just said, and they're like, yep, I got a meniscus injury. That might not be the case. Although it is, you know, very common, which kind of brings us to the next point of like, how common are these things? You know, what would you say, Drew? Like, is this a common thing? Like, is this like a knee problem we're seeing often? Is this rare? Like, I know we just talked about our patients are talking about it all the time, but you know, is this something clinically that is relevant?
Honestly, I think I see more tendon type injuries on a more common scale than I do like an actual meniscus tear. I think they're so common. I think they're commonly diagnosed by other providers, but I don't necessarily think they're as common in the general public. However, we'll have some interesting studies to present here. I'm going to let you take that, but I would say from my experience, they're not the most common knee injury that I would see in the clinic. I would say there's something that I do see, but I would not say they're the most common. So I don't think that the term meniscus tears holds its weight for how often people come in and assume that they have actually fully torn a meniscus and, you know, the kind of the doom and gloom that they get. So Craig, we got this study we want to talk about. Actually, we have several studies we want to talk about. So we actually have one here that discusses the annual prevalence of meniscus tears. And this is a pretty large study. So they did a really good job at looking at numbers. So Craig, I'll let you go through that right now.
Yeah, this is not a research-based podcast. That's not our thing, but I do love talking about the research. So let's get into it. So how common are meniscus tears? So when we're looking at like, when I say prevalence, like I mean annual prevalence. And that just means like if you took like, for example, 100,000 people, like what percentage of them at any given time have like a quote unquote torn meniscus? And this one's a little more common, somewhere in like the 12 to 14%. So that's a pretty high number when we're talking overall prevalence. You know, according to research, the meniscal lesion And by lesion, I mean like either degenerative or tear of the meniscus is the most common intra-articular knee injury. And by that, I just mean like the joint injury. So we're really kind of taking like muscles and tendons out of it. We're thinking joint injuries, meniscus lesion. So some damage to the meniscus, whether it be like a acute injury thing or like a degenerative over time thing is probably the most common. So how do we diagnose these things? Like what's the biggest thing that the patients come in with? Like when I see it, it's typically they have some sort of imaging. Like the big one is an MRI. Like I have knee pain, so I have to get my MRI for my knee because I, you know, I need to see what's going on in there. One of my favorite things to talk about patients with is a study that came out recently. Like this was over the past year where they took 230 people. Nobody had pain. And they took it from various like age ranges. Like they had a good bit of people under the age of 40. And their barometer was they had like 30 people under 40 and like 90 or 100 people over 40. And they just put them in an MRI machine. I said, let's see what we find out. You know, let's see what's abnormal. This study found that 97%. So of those 230 people, 227 showed some version of abnormality on the MRI and of varying degrees of severity, whether that be meniscal tears, cartilage abnormalities, bone marrow edema, or like a tendon or like a ligament abnormality. So when we like break that down a little bit, we see that of those people, of those asymptomatic people, no knee pain at all, 30% of them had a torn meniscus, and then a degenerative meniscus was found in an additional 18%. So
wow.
48%, so almost half, you know, had something essentially going on with the meniscus.
And you said no pain. These people had no pain at all.
Zero pain. So we've talked about this in the spine, you know, these like findings, like what do they mean? You know, like if you have no pain, but you do have these changes seen on the MRI, is that clinically relevant? You know, does it mean you have to have pain? You know, like making sense of that, I think, is very difficult. I think as a patient, that's like really tough to come to terms with because like our medical society, how we were raised is like a piece is broken, so it must be painful and it must be fixed. You know, I think like people have that kind of like that procedural, like very like black and white kind of looking at these things. And I think having a study like this kind of refutes that. And I think that can be a little hard to digest. Is that something you see, Drew? Like, what's your experience with this kind of stuff?
Well, honestly, again, I don't see a lot of MRIs. I don't see a lot of x-rays. And usually when people come to me, they already have pain. So they're not coming to me without it. But like when you hear studies like this that are done where they take this high volume of people, they stick them in MRI machines or some sort of imaging machine, they all have positive findings, but these people don't have any symptoms. It's alarming. So when you get a patient in front of you and you know this, and they say, hey, you know what, I have knee pain, I think I just need an MRI, and you're trying to explain to that patient, listen, if you get an MRI, there's a pretty high likelihood that it's not actually going to tell you what is wrong. Like if your problem is mechanical and there's nothing more serious going on, and we know that based off of my assessment, and the patient is so adamant on spending the money to get an MRI, and it's like, look, even if you didn't have knee pain and we stuck you in that machine, you're still going to show that there's something wrong. So it's not a very good way for us to be able to determine like, oh, this is the cause of the problem, because the likelihood that it's going to show a bunch of things wrong is pretty high. And I will say that a good portion of my patients who come in that are above the age of like 50 that have had an MRI, they tell me the same stories. My knee is bone on bone. Imaging told me that. They said that there's barely any cartilage left. They'll say that there's degenerative changes within the joint, and they'll say that they have a meniscus tear or something of that nature. And so they have all these things wrong with their knee. It gives them a really poor perception of their knee. And then at the end of rehab, oftentimes they're pain-free. So again, it's not that with what we're doing is we're not reversing that stuff. That stuff is just there. It's kind of part of normal aging, but it's hard to use that type of imaging because it's so powerful and it's picking up so much of this stuff that it's really hard for us to come to a conclusion about what's actually going on with the tissue involved.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, it's like such a challenge, you know, especially having no background in this stuff, you know,
nothing.
Like it fires us up because like we spent
we read it
years. We spent many years like looking at this stuff, you know. So I think that like we get frustrated, but I think at the end of the day, we also understand like where everybody's coming from. And that's like half the reason why we decided to do this podcast, you know.
That's
like,
why we're here.
That's why we do what we do, man. It's a tough job, but someone's got to
someone's got to do it, man.
Somebody's got to do it, you know.
All right, Craig. So the next burning question. Okay, so you get an MRI, you see a provider who does knee scopes, and the provider MRIs your knee. He says, "Look, you got a meniscal tear there. The next step is I think we need to get this scoped. What do you do?"
Man, what a challenging question that is, because it's like such a common surgery. Like anyone out there with knee pain, or you know people with knee pain, I bet you know someone that had this meniscus surgery. So again, let's just default back to some research and let's see, somebody spent a lot of time looking at this stuff. So let's see what they found out. There's like two different studies that we'll just kind of highlight today. So before we get into that, this is not a podcast about how to appraise research. I would say that I read a lot of it, but I'm still not very skilled in like getting into the nitty gritty. You can take details from statistics and studies and twist them any way you like. So I'm going to give you my take on this. And, you know,
you're so humble. You're so humble.
I feel that this means, you know. So before we even get into it, if we think of our pyramid of evidence, right? Like, what is bad evidence and what is good evidence? You know, like on our bottom row, we got expert opinion. It's good, but it's not the best. And then our next step up, we got.
Wait, 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 wait. You're telling me that my opinion isn't the MLB?
You're at the top. You're
at the very. Oh, thanks, Craig. Thank you.
The rest of us regulars are at the bottom. We're sitting out, hanging out at the bottom. So that's just like, you got a knee guy. His opinion, he's on the bottom. He's on the bottom. Next is our case series, which just means like you treated a bunch of knee patients and you just saw what happened. Good stuff, but not the best. So then you got your case controls, which is just better case studies, essentially. And you got your cohort studies, which is like, I went to a retirement home and I looked at everybody's knee. Great, but still not applicable to the whole world, you know? Next one up, randomized control trial, which means I took a bunch of random people and tried to get like a diverse group. And then I see what I found. Pretty high level. We like that. The pinnacle, just under Andrew, is the systematic review, which basically says like, I'm going to take as many high quality studies as I can find. I'm going to group them together and I'm going to see if they make some sort of, if we can draw a conclusion from them. So the two studies I'm going to talk about are systematic reviews. So they're pretty high quality. They took a bunch of other studies and then they put them together to make one statement. You know, like you can find one study to refute another one. Of course you can. But when you get them all together, what does it say? So, 13 of these randomized controlled trials and 12 observational studies. So a lot of good studies with thousands of patients. I think it was like 20,000 patients or something like that.
That's a huge sample size for people who don't, you know, who don't read research. That's a really good.
That's a pretty high number for PT stuff. That's a pretty high number for rehab stuff. And what did they say? They said that they had high quality evidence. So they were confident that the procedure, so the meniscus surgery, provides very small benefits in pain and function over conservative therapy in the short term, and the evidence fails to support a persistence of any long-term benefits. So that was like basically 2 years of follow-up. So basically people that got surgery and people that got physical therapy or conservative management, they did about the same in the short term, and then they were about the same 2 years later. So essentially they're just saying that they are not really big fans of the surgery. The evidence doesn't really point to it being, you know, overly beneficial. One thing I found interesting is they mentioned, they said that patients and their healthcare providers, they have to trade off the marginal short-term benefits against the burden of the surgical procedure. So they're kind of saying like, when you have surgery, like, you know, you're going to be out for 2 to 6 weeks. That's just like the nature of the surgery. And like, will your knee feel a little bit better then? Yeah. I mean, you're not really using it. So it's like, is that trade of that short-term, you know, taking a bunch of time off worth it? They're starting to think no, you know. The second study we'll talk about was similar thing, but they looked at just patients 40 years and older, because what is pretty consistent in like all the literature is the older you are, the more likely you are to have degenerative changes in your knee. No secret there, you know, that's not a surprise. So again, got a bunch of randomized controlled trials, good evidence, and they found the same thing as the other big study we were talking about, that surgery was not superior to conservative management and patients with this like meniscal pathology. So especially if you're 40 years and older, and if you're listening to this podcast, if you just go right in and they just say, yep, knee pain, we got to get you in there and get it scoped. I don't think that that is a satisfactory way to management. And that's just not me saying it, you know, like, I think there's actually some good, hard, objective data, you know, to back it up. So I don't know if you have anything to add there, Drew, or, you know, our next point is like, is the surgery dangerous, you know, because any type of surgery, there's like some complications, you know, like, can you speak to that? Or, you know, do you got anything else about the number one question, you know, do you get the knee scope?
I don't get the knee scope. Obviously I'm a little bit biased, but I don't get the knee scope. I do see very similar results and findings to what those studies reported. So that is something like on my end that I'd agree with. I do think there's a lot of people walking around with, you know, positive MRIs that have very little knee pain that has to do with what that MRI said. And then I also think on the tail end of that is I've seen people who get knee scopes and things look relatively the same. They're actually in pain many years later, and then it sets them up for scope number two or scope number three. And then it leads to, you know, another procedure down the line. So I'm all for keeping your original anatomy and, you know, kind of just sticking through it and going the old fashioned rehab route, because I think there's a lot that we have to offer. So yeah, that's kind of where I stand on that. As far as like surgery and complications, I mean, there's so many things that can happen. You know, you open yourself up to, you know, you have to go under, so you have the general anesthesia. Some people don't tolerate that as well as others. So you can get nausea, vomiting. Obviously, you're going to have tons of soreness, pain, and swelling around your incision site. I think people don't realize, like, it's really interesting to me. When people go to physical therapy, sometimes they assume that physical therapy is going to hurt or not feel good. But for whatever reason with surgery, they also don't always realize that, like, hey, you just had surgery. You're not going to be able to move very well. Like, you're going to have to, like, take 4 to 5 to 6 weeks off and, like, protect this for a while. And then you're going to have to go to physical therapy on top of that. So I think sometimes think that surgery is the quicker fix for some of these problems, when we're going to look at some of the differences here with some of these procedures in a little bit. But a lot of times surgery just really draws out the process of recovery. Whereas, you know, with more conservative care, you can get the job done a little quicker. But yeah, you have the soreness, pain, and swelling around the incision site. Obviously you're going to lose some sleep. You're in pain. You can't move. You know, you can also get major complications. So those are just like some of the smaller things. You can go into shock. There's also like the incision getting infected, which is really the biggest risk of surgery, is some sort of infection. Blood clots are things that can happen. Different types of medications can alter your blood pressure, or coincide with other medications that, you know, are giving you negative effects. So, I mean, there's so many different things that can happen, when you go that route, all to, you know, just have something scoped and then 2 years out have the exact same outcomes as if you either did nothing or had physical therapy. So, you know, in my head, you're way better off actually going out there, getting some standard treatment done, you know, saving yourself the potential risks of surgery.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. There is a little stuff out there, like, this would be time for like maybe another podcast, but like there is a little bit of evidence saying that like you do get these meniscectomies or other surgical interventions, and it could just ever so slightly mess with your knee mechanics just enough that could lead to like, you know, arthritis or articular cartilage defects later in life. That's like we're a little less confident about that, but you know, I think in the future we could be more confident about it, or we could be less, you know, but it is something to think about.
It definitely does change the joint mechanics, because I will say that there are things after someone has a scope or a meniscal repair or something like that, that techniques that typically do work for people who, you know, have a normal knee that hasn't been altered, they don't work for somebody who has had surgery in the past, or at least they don't work as well. That's just anecdotal. You know, I'm on the lower tier of the evidence there, but I do find that as something to be, you know, to hold its weight within my years of practice. So, but Craig, let's say somebody has a scope versus a meniscal repair. What do these recovery times look like? And then what do recovery times look like for PT? Because I know, again, if we're going to sit here and we're going to say, hey, you probably shouldn't get that knee scope right away. You should try PT first. We have to at least talk about what all these timelines are so that the general public has a better understanding of, hey, this is what I'm getting myself into.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that I'm happy that we do is like talk about some prognosis stuff, because I think a lot of times people don't get this information. So you mentioned two different kinds of surgeries, and we're not going to get super in depth to it, but if you have, you know, it can go one of two ways. So you can have your meniscus repaired. Like we said, those two little C structures, they can sew the part back together that is torn. There's a whole conversation on why they do that. But as you can imagine, if you have this repair in there, the repair needs to heal, essentially. And if we remember, the meniscus are shock absorbers on the knee. So if we're constantly weight bearing and you know, pressing on to that repair, it, you know, can't really heal the way that it should. So there is like a period of, you know, non-weight bearing and gradual return to walking. And as you can imagine, that takes a while. So I would say the average, like textbook, you know, if you would look it up, recovery time from a meniscus repair can range anywhere between 3 to 6 months. Like I said, there has to be that period. You have to let the repair heal. And there's like a certain, you have to just be careful with what you're doing as you're in the healing process, you know? So it does take a little bit longer. If you had the meniscectomy or the true knee scope, which basically just means they go in, they see the torn part of the meniscus and they just take it out. So no repair to worry about. You can, you know, it's typically like immediately weight bearing. You can walk and kind of do most of your stuff. Again, the book definition would be a recovery of 4 to 6 weeks. This one, clinically, for me, it's a little bit longer. I at least tell patients to expect a little bit longer. Again, bottom of the evidence pyramid, because that's just my opinion, you know. But just from my clinical experience after doing this couple years, I would budget out a little bit more than 6 weeks. So what's the PT plan of care then? Like if we're saying we're more effective, you know, like how long is it going to take us? So I would say on average, and we're way more variable, right? Depends on the person. There's like so many other factors going into it, but I would say anywhere in the 5 to 8 week range. Could it be shorter? Yes. Could it be longer? You know, absolutely. Yes. So it's kind of similar to like this meniscectomy surgery, right? And I think one thing with the PT aspect that we fail to mention, and I talk about this all the time, is after you have surgery, there is a period of immobilization and like a kind of standardized rest and active recovery period. You understand, I just had surgery. I'm going to take a couple of weeks off work. I'm just going to elevate my leg. I'm going to do some light exercise. And then when things start to feel better, I'm going to just slowly and gradually get back to where I was before, which that sounds a lot like my job, a physical therapist, is to do the same thing for you, you know? But I think as like a patient, we're less like that mindset just isn't there. Like, okay, I'm going to, you know, take a couple steps back from my normal activity. We're going to get the pain under control and we're gradually going to build ourselves back up. Like it's almost like a carbon copy, but I think that that like mental, like the mentality there just kind of gets lost. So I would be really interested to see like if people have like this mandatory active rest period when they even go under like these conservative management, how they would do. So that's my little soapbox about that. What about you, Drew? What are your numbers?
You know, I'd say my numbers are pretty spot on with that. I would say between the 5 to 8 week mark is on average when I see somebody who has a meniscus issue, how long it takes me to treat it. But I think more importantly is I'm actually starting to see more frequently people get or report they got or had a meniscectomy and they did not have any rehab. They were just told, hey, we cut the bad part out. Just take it easy for like 6 weeks, don't do a lot on your knee and you'll be fine, back to normal. I've actually seen athletes return back to sport, re-injure themselves. And the reason why this is a bad idea is because there's major trauma to that area. There's swelling, even though it's considered minimally invasive, there's still trauma to that area. There's swelling. There's muscles will likely shut down. Like your quad is one of your key muscles that gives you knee support. Doesn't matter what type of procedure you get, that quad decides to weaken and doesn't activate as much as it should. And by not having that these different areas strategically loaded and bringing patients back to their full capacity, it oftentimes leads to re-injury sooner rather than later. And as we know already, the, you know, 2 years out, the outcomes really aren't all that great in the long run. So if you sit back and think about it, if you don't do anything to strengthen after you have a meniscectomy, and you just go on like living your normal life after about 4 to 6 weeks, without anything specifically geared towards, you know, getting you back to normal as best as possible, you're just setting yourself up for failure. So I'm seeing that more and more frequently. I'm also seeing that with hip replacements as well. I know that's a completely different topic, but I'm seeing people who are getting hip replacements. They're being told, oh, just walk a whole bunch, and then not getting any sort of skilled PT at the end. And I think a huge part of that is also financial gain. But again, that's for a whole nother day. So Craig, we touched on a lot today, all things meniscus, except for physical therapy treatment. So I think we're going to have to do a whole nother podcast on what we do to treat meniscus issues. And I really do think it could be a whole podcast. So maybe that'll be a part two to this one. So why don't you wrap us up and we'll go from there.
So in conclusion, just kind of wrapping everything up, if you have knee pain, especially if you're over the age of 40 and you're listening to this and you get, you know, the almighty MRI, you know, that everybody must have, just know that there's a high likelihood that something, some type of pathology or irregularity or whatever you want to call it, you might be seen on there. But remember, MRIs and imaging is just a piece of the puzzle. A good clinical exam and just kind of like a picture of the patient as a whole is key here. So just because there's a picture saying something is wrong does not mean you have to be in pain. Number two, as of right now, the research kind of doesn't really show too much of a benefit for meniscus surgeries. So at this time, like, I don't think we can really recommend them. Based off what we know today, I would say that it's irresponsible management if you have knee pain or we're thinking it's like meniscal in nature. You need to get conservative therapy or you need to get conservative management in some capacity. Last point, like you said, Drew, just stay tuned for part two, because we talked a lot about what it is and how common it is, but how do we fix it? That's the million-dollar question. So hang around and we'll be back with another one.
Awesome. Yeah. Get PT first for knee pain. If PT isn't solving the problem, then we look to other options. So I'm right there with you, Craig. All right. Thank you for tuning into the Straight Talk Physio podcast. If you like what you're hearing, it would mean the world to us if you subscribe to this podcast and the Peak Physiotherapy and Performance YouTube channel. For more information about us, please check us out on Facebook at Peak Physiotherapy and Performance and on Instagram at P3 Physiotherapy. For more information about Craig, you can follow him at Dr. Craig G_PT on Twitter and Instagram. If you have any topic suggestions, comments, or questions, then feel free to email us at thestraighttalkphysiopodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for watching, and we hope you have an awesome day.